Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin is home to the nation's only Master Cheesemakers program that provides innovative cheesemakers with continuing education opportunities? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow. And
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. And I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So it's a beautiful Sunday here in summer, in Brooklyn, but unfortunately summer is sort of on the wane, and I hope everyone is enjoying a lot of time outside during your travels or just walks throughout the park. And if you're anything like me, you might be wondering, you know, what is that berry or what is that fragrant smelling herb that is just hanging out here and while you're frolicking outside? I have an expert who can tell you all about those kinds of things, and I'm really excited to talk with her. She is a foraging maven, and she's the author of the blog 66 Square Feet, but also a book by that name. And her new book is called Forage Harvest Feast, a wild-inspired cuisine. And she takes us through almost 500 or so culinary edible herbs that you can find in the wild. So I'm really pleased to have Marie Filquen on the show. And I'm still getting to know her last name.
I like this version.
Okay. Help me practice that. Is it?
It's pronounced Filquen.
Filquen.
Afrikaans, straight from South Africa.
Okay, but originally French?
Originally French, yeah, Villon. So I have a poet's blood in my veins, apparently, long ago, François Villon. So, of course, I write about recipes and foraging, not poetry.
No, I think there's something so poetic about the way you write about these plants and sort of capture the magic of foraging as almost a spiritual endeavor. Do you see it as spiritual?
I see it mostly as something to feed a really hungry person. If that's spiritual, yes.
Well, just to be sure, you write about, you know, foraging for pleasure, not for sustenance, right? Not like for survival skills.
Exactly. I mean, there are so many different foragers out there. And as foraging becomes increasingly trendy, I think they break off into little splinter groups of foraging. So I'm not one of the survivalists.
Got it.
Although you'd probably, you know, be well off with me and your group should the apocalypse happen and somehow magically there are still plants left on the planet.
Right. Well, okay. I love how you recall growing up in South Africa, foraging, and your mom had some wisdom around that, mushrooms here and there. And then your housekeeper had some knowledge about native plants too. So tell me a little bit about how you got into foraging.
You know, back in that day, foraging wasn't the word. It was a word you might find in literature. Somebody would go foraging for the military, or animals would forage. In those days, and I think in many cultures, what we now call foraging was just going out seasonally and picking whatever was in season, like mushrooms in autumn or watercress in the middle of summer. It was just one of those little seasonal perks where you don't go to the shop. You go and pick something that's wild and fresh and free, so something kind of exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part of foraging that appeals the most to people. It's unexpected. It's available in a really small, particular window of time. And it's free.
And it's something, it sounds like it wasn't unusual, like when you were growing up.
Not particularly unusual. I mean, it wasn't something we were doing every day, but absolutely every season had the plant associated with it. And because my mother was a really good gardener, I've always thought of plants and food and foraging kind of in the same breath. They're all so related.
That's really cool. So you now live in Brooklyn, and you mentioned that you got into the local, I guess, plants or terroir through going on a walk with Wildman Steve Brill.
I think a lot of people have got into it through Steve Brill, who is a renowned character. Mm-hmm. He and his pith helmet. you often see him leading walks in the city parks. I'd been very interested in American plants for a while because I was working as a garden designer, and I had become acquainted with indigenous foods like service berries, these delicious berries that are ripe every June in New York City and all over the country. But it was on a walk with him that I started to pay attention to weeds. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really thinking weeds, edible plants, but really they're often just another vegetable with a really bad rap.
Right. With an illegitimate sort of reputation.
Exactly. Yeah. And since our language has evolved with people, it's also evolved with plants, and we're reconsidering edible weeds. Mm-hmm. So plants that are sort of previously known as trash plants are part of my focus. I think it's fantastic to eat pigweed, pokeweed.
Mm-hmm. Plants. They don't always have the most beautiful names, though.
Exactly. They have horrible names. Yeah. And
mugwort.
Mugwort. Although mugwort's kind of cool because it goes in a mug, beer mug. Mugwort is traditionally used to make beer in Europe, and it's an essential ingredient in vermouth in Europe. You can't call it vermouth unless it has Artemisia vulgaris in it. I mean, even vulgaris is not kind of a nice species name.
That's a tough one.
It really just means very common, but something that's vulgar is everywhere. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
We should rebrand.
Yeah, and I, too, have enjoyed Wildman Steve Brill's walks and got into foraging a little bit there, but it always seems so... you know, it's hard to access it sometimes. I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their heads around actually doing this outside the occasional dilly-dally. So I'm curious what you would say to folks who are just like, really? I don't know.
Well, on the one hand, they have a really good point, especially if you're foraging in a city. There are some really filthy places in any city, in any urban park. So there's the just ick factor. On the other hand, if you're someone like me, you can't help seeing plants and identifying them without even realizing you're doing it. So I see plants everywhere, and I know what most of them are. And it's really, really hard to walk past something that's completely delicious and just standing there and just ignore it. So I tend to pounce if it's growing in a clean area. And even in a city like New York, there are big green spaces where you could walk for an hour and not see another human being, which still surprises me.
Yeah.
So you just need to be a bit discerning.
And I like how you mentioned if you're already a gardener, too, you can sometimes identify weeds, quote unquote weeds, that are growing just in your own backyard.
Well, exactly. A lot of the things, you know, like last night we had a weed called quickweed in our dinner. It was just quickly sauteed and delicious. And this is like a scourge for most farmers and gardeners. And what I think is really appealing about this weed, which is a legitimate vegetable in Colombia, for instance, where it's called huascas, it's an essential ingredient there in a stew called ajiaco. Why are we just spraying Roundup on it? Because we don't know. So that's very appealing to me, and I'm hoping increasingly that it's appealing to farmers. They have all these edible weeds on their land, which they're either spraying into submission or that are choking their regular crops.
Right.
So hopefully with Forage Harvest Feast, some of these recipes are going to be an incentive for farmers and gardeners to go, oh, hang on, there's potential in this weed. It's delicious, and I can maybe sell it.
Absolutely, and let's make the task of weeding harvesting at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't love that idea? I love that you mentioned that, you know, Here, you can find uniquely American flavors in the Forage edibles. What are some of those flavors that you feel are so, you know, just American?
They're so exciting, and it's funny for a South African to be talking about American flavors, but perhaps it takes an outside point of view sometimes to recognize what's growing under our noses. North America, the United States, still lacks regional cuisines. This is beginning to change, especially, I think, in the last maybe 5 years. We have indigenous plants growing, especially in the Northeast, but across the country, which are as regional and as unique as thyme is, for instance, to the Mediterranean. We've forgotten that thyme comes from the Mediterranean. It's just a culinary herb. But in the Northeast and across the country, we have bayberry. Mm. We have spicebush. There are so many indigenous flavors, like sweet fern, that have a unique flavor profile and that I think should be informing an emerging collection of regional cuisines.
Mm-hmm. There's like so many different plants I've never heard of here, but some are very common sounding. I mean, there's garlic mustard. It's a more kind of spicy mustard.
Yeah, garlic mustard is a horrible weed. It's like a complete botanical thug, and it tastes, I think, like mustard, garlic, just like its name, and probably more like broccoli rabe for people who like a slightly bitter flavor. It's amazing. Very good in springtime.
Yeah. I like that. Okay. I want to talk more about this, vinegars and the elderberry vinegar that you have and the sumac sugar and stuff. But, for one second, let's go to vermouth, because you write that that's a wonderful way of exploring, translating a certain place to the palate. I thought that was a really interesting idea. Why is that so special for vermouth?
Vermouth is fun. It contains lots, really as many as you like, lots of botanicals. And the way you make vermouth, if you're making it at home, I infuse lots of different herbs and sometimes flowers and fruit in high-proof alcohol. Vodka is a good one if you find a relatively neutral vodka.
Got it.
Once they're all infused, and they infuse for different periods of time, you start blending them, and that's the sort of art form and depends on your palate.
Right.
With a good white wine. So you're basically fortifying the white wine with an array of seasonal botanicals. And this is incredibly exciting.
So fun.
Yeah. I mean, you can do it in early spring, late spring, midsummer, late fall. You have a vermouth from a place because you're picking all those botanicals in a very particular place. And from a very particular place in time, which I think is just incredibly evocative. And then you drink it, which is always fun.
That is so cool. This is like a cocktail mixologist dream come true, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Does anyone ever call you a modern witch?
Not yet, thank you.
I'm just like looking at so many of these like crafty ideas that you came up with.
I do have red hair and I used to have a black cat, so.
I just popped it into my head there. Not that that's, I don't mean that in a bad way, hopefully.
No, I'll take it as a compliment. Don't mess with me.
All right. Okay. Yikes. So you're right. Can I read a little bit from your introduction? Because I think this is like really beautifully sums up, you know, some of what you're doing here. You write, most of us are used to eating passively. We eat what is put before us, neatly labeled and easily recognizable. We are not sure how it got there, how many people handled it, or what was required to grow it. But there it is. Foraging requires an interaction with and an awareness of our surroundings and our food in a way that mere consumption does not. You have agency. I love that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Inspiring.
It's foraging can lead you down quite a lot of philosophical side roads because it really makes you question food. What is food? You have to identify it. You have to figure out if it's poisonous and then how to prepare it to make it delicious.
Right. And then you realize that vermouth is just whatever people wanted to, you know, whichever herbs you wanted to infuse. It's not just this one standard green bottle.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, recently a lot of new vermouths have been emerging and people are beginning to appreciate that on a consumer scale. But what I'm still missing in some vermouths is a feeling of the indigenous, of This is an American selection of plants because they're really worthwhile in terms of spice, flavor, herbal quality. And then throw in some invasive weeds just to kind of make it fun on that spectrum.
Yeah, well, maybe that's an untapped idea there. Hopefully people are listening. We're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude right now and be right back chatting more about some of your recipes.
It's true. I could have done better. But I won't be bullied to fully take the blame.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious, stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sutari's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
All right, and we're back chatting more with Marie Villeroyen. No.
Even better.
I did it.
Villeroyen.
Villeroyen.
Oh, you make it sound so French. It's very elegant.
Oh. That's all I know. I don't know Afrikaans. I'm sorry.
Who does?
Okay, all right. Marie Villeroyen. whose new book is called Forage Harvest Feast, out just now from Chelsea Green. So I love this book. It is so informative. And I love that you brought me some gifts. So tell me a little bit more about this beautiful canary yellow sort of elderflower vinegar in this bottle.
Elderflowers, yeah, they're so versatile and so floral. And they're one of the plants that everybody recognizes.
Elderberries, yeah.
Exactly. So they're like a gateway plant to foraging. So they're ready in like late May. And most people make an elderflower syrup or cordial. Mm-hmm. I do that by fermenting the flowers. So after a few days, they're super fizzy and effervescent.
Mm-hmm. You can make an elderflower ice cream or soda or whatever.
Yeah. So that cordial can be used in all sorts of ways. I cook with it as well. It goes really well with sea bass.
Oh.
But if you leave it for a few more weeks, once it's strained and you're lucky, you get genuine vinegar. I don't use vinegar mothers. They tend to form spontaneously.
Oh, wow.
Which is fantastic. So
are
I have
kidding?
This total weird collection of vinegars at home with all different kinds. Of, my husband's really scared of them. But
he's eating them every day. He doesn't know it.
Sometimes I don't tell him. the vinegar to me is very versatile. Mm-hmm. I like tart flavors more than sweet, actually. So much more useful in a kitchen. So I'll do anything with vinegar. Salad dressing, of course, then cocktails, mocktails.
Elderflower shrub.
Absolutely. And then great for braising. Braising in vinegar, especially a really aromatic one, is delicious. Braise some duck legs in elderflower vinegar. Yum, yum, yum.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds wonderful. Cut that fattiness, too.
Exactly.
All right. So this is Aronia syrup?
That's Aronia syrup. Aronia. So Aronia, if you Google Aronia, you'll get a lot of hits on the internet about supplements. Mm-hmm. It's very popular as a supplement. If it works or not as a supplement, couldn't tell you. I'm a bit of a skeptic. Mm-hmm. But this is ripe sort of August on through November.
Okay.
I usually pick them when there's been a little cold snap and the fruit gets a little sweeter because it's quite tannic, quite tart, but very complex once you start fermenting or turning it into a syrup.
Cool. And these look like blackberries or something?
They look a little bit like blueberries, but they don't taste as friendly as a blueberry. Okay. It's really once you start cooking with it or exposing it to heat or good bacteria that something really magical happens. And that's one of the things I like foraging too. You preserve things. So you have, once you've done it for a year or two, an entire pantry of ingredients to draw from.
I love it.
For, you know, an indefinite amount
it's
of
beautiful.
Time.
Beautiful. And this syrup looks like a cherry juice or maybe a red wine. It's beautiful.
Yeah, that one I think I fermented. So again, it got pretty fizzy for a while. And once it wasn't active anymore, I bottled it and there it is. I mix it into cocktails, drinks, add a dash to Prosecco.
Can't wait
duck
to try
breasts,
it.
Pork.
Yeah, add a little bit of color too.
Yeah.
So a lot of foraged foods that many people might recognize are actually one in particular I wanted to bring up is ramps. These are spring onions that are wild, and we now see them at a lot of farmers markets in the spring. But you didn't want to include a whole section on them in your book. Why is that?
It was actually a hard decision to include ramps because ramps are now well known as a wild and very appealing food. They taste like garlic. They taste like spring onions. They're very versatile. The problem with ramps is everyone does recognize them now. Chefs have created a big demand. Food writers like me have created a big demand. And ramps are an indigenous onion. They grow very, very slowly. So if you denude an entire ramp patch, that's pretty much it for the ramp patch. And some commercial foragers, to fulfill a demand that now includes big stores like Whole Foods or even your local grocery sometimes, will just clean out indiscriminately. And there's an art to collecting ramps. And when you collect them properly, there are some problems. One of the problems is you have to collect them slowly. So if you're adding time to your forage as a commercial forager, you're also adding money. So forage more slowly. Pick the fat ramp from a clump. Better yet, just pick the leaves. Increasingly, especially on social media, I'm seeing people become aware of the fact that it's actually better just to collect the leaves, to leave the bulbs under the ground to allow them to keep reproducing. I mean, I can go on at length about ramps, but if you're shopping for ramps in the springtime and you'll see them in April or May, you need to look for a few things. If you see very skinny ramps that are very, very thin and have their roots still attached, it's probably a good sign that a ramp patch has been cleaned out.
That doesn't sound like a good idea.
Yeah, you need fat ramps.
Fat ones.
Which means they're the biggest in a clump of ramps. Each ramp patch grows in little clumps. Ideally, you're looking for ramps without roots. So it's quite hard for a forager to do, to dig them up and leave the root in the ground. It means you're cutting every single ramp.
That's a shame.
Even better, just a bunch of leaves. The leaves are packed with flavor. I'd almost say they're more flavorful than the bulbs.
Right. And there's so many other kinds of wild alliums with similar flavor profiles. We just talked about the garlic, what is it called? Mustard greens. And then there's all sorts of wild garlics and onions.
Yeah. Field garlic is a good wild, weedy garlic. And it's prolific. It's all over the place. It's smaller than ramps, but it's very powerfully flavored. It's very invasive. So picking as much field garlic as you like, this is totally fine. And occasionally, I'm seeing field garlic now at farmers markets. Lani's Farm, based in New Jersey, sell it every single year. So I crack up when I see a $5 bunch of field garlic. But I'm like, this is fantastic, because maybe we can slowly wean people off ramps.
Right, right. But then, what about the danger of decimating a different type of plant? Do you worry that in popularizing or writing about it, because you mentioned that, you know, food writers like us, we unwittingly sign the death certificate for the ramps.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
In a lot of places.
Yes, I have concerns about, say, common milkweed. So again, milkweed means it's viewed as a weed. Common milkweed is becoming popular in monarch butterfly circles because increasingly people are aware that monarch butterflies lay their eggs on common milkweed and their larvae, which are the caterpillars, feed on the leaves. So milkweed is important because monarch butterflies are under threat and need more milkweed. along comes the forager, like me, and decides that milkweed shoots and buds and flowers are delicious, because they really, really are. This is like a Native American vegetable that we've all forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel conflicted when I post a picture of, say, milkweed flower cordial on Instagram, or the other night we had fried milkweed pods with a whole bunch of shrimp. Absolutely delicious.
Ooh.
But if people don't realize how common milkweed fits into the bigger ecological picture,
mm-hmm.
You have a situation where you have a walk-in fridge in a restaurant with a whole bunch of milkweed just lying there. It's been picked at the wrong time of the year. It's wilting. They don't know how to prepare it.
Mm-hmm.
But that patch has been cleaned out. This happened to a friend of mine. I won't mention the restaurant or who the friend was, but she was just appalled to see all this milkweed lying there with no real idea on the chef's part of how to use it. He just saw that it was a good thing to eat, said to his forager, go get it. Forager got it. Forager didn't understand when to pick it.
Oh.
So some botanical background and context is always important, especially when you're talking about an indigenous plant.
Mm-hmm.
I grow milkweed in my Brooklyn garden. I'm lucky to have a backyard, but it grows fantastically. And increasingly, I'm talking to farmers who are very curious about bringing it to market. They get rid of it on their farms. They don't like their cows to graze it, so it's a pest. They get rid of it by spraying it instead of doing that.
And yet some other plants, it's like the more you pick them, the more you help sort of spread them around, right? Is that some,
in some cases, yeah. In some cases, you could spread them around by spreading seed.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting, and I love how this book has, like, you know, things to look out for. They have complete profiles of each of these plants, but also, you know, how to pick them properly, because it's not always the case that you can decimate a whole batch of them, like with ramps. So many wonderful sounding recipes here. There's lamb's quarter, nudie, tons of recipes with common dandelion, which is just everywhere, and it's so much fun to play around with. What would you say is a good recipe for, like, the real true beginner to, I don't know, what would you recommend?
Oh, it depends on the season. I mean, you know, name a month.
Right now.
So right now, elderberries.
Okay.
We had the elderflowers in May, and now elderberries are ripening. And they're also super recognizable to most people.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick an elderberry off the bush, it tastes very blah, bland, boring. But the minute you expose it to heat, something miraculous happens. So what I would do for a super simple recipe is you combine elderberries with a little bit of sugar, a little bit of water, cook them for half an hour, strain, and you have the most incredibly rich syrup, which is also very good for you. It's proven to be antiviral.
Oh my goodness.
I always have some syrup on hand in winter in case I get sick. And it's a fantastic ingredient. I use it in all kinds of things.
Wow. And where can we find an elderberry bush usually?
Elderberry, you know, foraging is opportunistic. And a lot of people always say to me, well, where do I find this? Where do I find that? And the answer is keep your eyes open.
Mm-hmm.
It really teaches you to observe and to spot plants. Mm-hmm. Once you see an elderberry bush, you're going to see them everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all over the city. They're all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
There are not a whole lot of plants I can think of that you could confuse with elderberry at this time of year. And again, it's a very well-known European forage, for instance, so there's plenty of pictures of it out there.
Perfect.
Keep your eyes open.
Yeah, I can't wait. And now that I have this elderberry vinegar, I'm going to definitely try some more uses for it soon.
Yeah, I hope you have fun.
Thank you so much. So this book is really, really an amazing resource. It has tons of recipes and information about all these plants, not weeds, but plants, culinary ingredients, that is. So I hope everyone gets their hands on it soon, but that's about all the time we have for today, Marie.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining. And keep watching her 66 Square Feet at Instagram. There's a blog. You sometimes do foraging walks, so look out for those coming up on your calendar.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, everyone. And have a great week at Heritage Radio Network. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Oh.